Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. President Donald Trump Wednesday ordered construction of a wall along the country's southern border with Mexico. The wall is intended to thwart illegal migration. The president also wants to pull some funds from hundreds of so-called sanctuary cities, those that are refusing to help local authorities identify and deport illegal aliens. Mr. Trump signed the immigration executive orders as he visited the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency charged with protecting the U.S. border.
From here on out, I'm asking all of you to enforce the laws of the United States of America. They will be enforced and enforced strongly.
Officials say Mr. Trump is also considering a four-month freeze on all refugee admissions into the U.S., as well as a ban for at least 30 days for entry by anyone from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. Gambia's new president, Adama Barrow, plans to return to the country Thursday. He fled after longtime leader Yahya Jammeh refused to acknowledge an election loss and sought to stay in office. When West African countries began a military intervention, Mr. Jammeh was forced to leave. Khalifa Salah is a spokesman for Mr. Barrow.
He informed me 2 days ago that on Thursday he would be here, but would not want it to be announced because he had to also thank those people who have actually contributed to the settlement of the political dispute in the Gambia in peace.
The United Nations has deployed officials to Gambia to help ensure a smooth transition. This is VOA News. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above 20,000 for the first time ever Wednesday. The Dow is the most well-known U.S. stock market index. The S&P 500, a broader index, also reached a record high. American actress Mary Tyler Moore died Wednesday in New York. No cause of death was announced. She was 80 years old. Republican leaders met in Philadelphia Wednesday to devise a strategy for repealing former President Barack Obama's health care plan. They also discussed rewriting the tax code. The GOP leaders drew up a list of legislative items they hope to work on in their first 200 days under President Trump. The New York Times newspaper is reporting that the Trump administration is thinking about making cuts in U.S. contributions to the United Nations. The Times says it has seen two papers outlining potential action by the government. One draft would end U.S. funding of any U.N.-affiliated agency that allows full membership for the Palestinian Authority. The other draft calls for at least 40% overall decrease in U.S. support for international organizations. The United States currently pays 22% of the U.N.'s regular budget. President Trump is calling for an investigation into alleged voter fraud in November's presidential election. He announced plans for the probe Wednesday. A White House spokesman says the upcoming investigation will not just be about the election, but about the integrity of the American voting system. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis plans to travel to Japan and South Korea next month. It will be his first trip abroad as the head of the Pentagon. The trip underlines the importance the new administration puts on U.S. alliances with Japan and South Korea. British Prime Minister Theresa May says she will publish her plan for Britain to leave the European Union in Parliament so members can take a look at it. She repeated that her government is on track to achieve Brexit. Pope Francis has taken over the Knights of Malta following a dispute with the order's leader. Christopher Lamb is the Vatican correspondent for The Table.
The Knights of Malta's leader has resigned following a public row with the Pope and the Vatican after the leader, Matthew Festing, sacked a top aide in a row about the distribution of condoms.
The Knights of Malta run a worldwide charity operation. The papal takeover is seen as unusual because, unlike many other orders, the Knights are a sovereign entity. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini met Wednesday with the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo to encourage them to press harder to normalize relations with each other. The two nations have seen an increase in tensions in recent days. Kosovo declared its independence from Serbia in 2008, but that's not yet been recognized by Serbia. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Anticipation is high in Banjul as Gambian President Adama Barrow is set to return home today, Thursday.
I was a supporter of the former president, but I believe what people decide. That's what we all yearning for. We want progress, peace, development for our people. So we are praying for Barrow, for him to succeed in his tenure office.
Casa Samura is one of the Gambians awaiting the arrival today of their new president. The United Nations deploys officials to the Gambia to help ensure a smooth transition. We'll speak with the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa. And the United Nations says human rights abuses in the Democratic Republic of Congo increased in 2016.
We're particularly worried about a dramatic increase in human rights violations documented in the territory of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Jose Maria Arenas is the director of the UN Human Rights Office. A new report says the rise of populist politicians threatens to erode human rights worldwide, and U.S. President Donald Trump orders the building of a wall on the border with Mexico and freezes refugee admissions. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gambia's newly elected president, Adama Barrow, will return to his country today, Thursday, after fleeing earlier this year, fearing for his safety from now former President Yahya Jammeh. President Barrow faces enormous challenges as he returns home, including how to ensure national security, stability, and peace. On Wednesday, Mr. Barrow appointed former Chief of Defense Staff of the Gambian Army, General Massane Kinte, as his security advisor. On the line from Dakar is VOA Stringer Sini Mariner. Good morning to you again, Sini.
Good morning, James, once again.
You are there in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, where we know that President Adama Barrow is today leaving for Banjul. How true is that?
Yes, President Adama Barrow will return to Banjul today at 4 p.m. local time after giving security clearance by ECOWAS forces in collaboration with Gambia Armed Forces. Adama Barrow has been staying in Dakar for almost 2 weeks due to security reasons.
We know that President Barrow has also named his security advisor. Who exactly is that?
Yesterday, President Adama Barrow named former Chief of Defense Staff of the Gambia Armed Forces, Lieutenant General Massane Kinte, who served as an ambassador to Juba. Mr. Kinte is an experienced military officer who holds a degree in political and military science from University of UK. At a press conference in Banjul, Khalifa Sallah confirmed the nomination of Lieutenant General Massane Kinte, who will be responsible for President Barrow's security, and he will be advising him on security-related matters.
Sydney, we know that there are many challenges awaiting Mr. Barrow. I'm thinking that perhaps the issue of security and stability should be top in line. But to do this, he will have to deal with the security apparatus that was created by former President Yahya Jammeh. How does he intend to deal with that?
This is one of the reasons President Adama Barrow appointed Lieutenant General Massane Kinte. Massane, as I said, is a well-experienced Gambian military officer. His career spanned over 2 decades. So one of the priorities of the president is to ensure the safety and security of himself and the Gambians in general. So the issue here will be hand in hand with ECOWAS forces to ensure that the security of Gambians is guaranteed. As you said, that is one of the key priorities because he inherited a country that has been, you know, destroyed partly by Yahya Jammeh.
Talking about former President Yahya Jammeh's security apparatus, how is he going to deal with that?
This is why, according to the information, President Adama Barrow will not, in fact, be housed at State House. He will be housed at his residence to ensure that the entire security of State House is neutralized.
When we spoke earlier this week, you mentioned how the president named his vice president and how some people had raised constitutional concerns about that appointment. Did the president have anything to say at all?
The president confirmed that the appointment of his vice president, Fatoumata Tambajan Jallo, conformity with the Constitution of the Gambia. This follows a lot of controversy raised by Gambian activists and ordinary Gambians as to whether her appointment was constitutional, because our Constitution says a VP must be below age of 65, and people say Fatoumata is above 65 years. But when I spoke with the president briefly, he told me that his appointment of Fatoumata Tambadjan is indeed in line with the Constitution of the Gambia.
Seni, thank you very much again. We do appreciate your reporting.
Thank you, sir.
That's Vio Strength of Seni Mariner speaking with us from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Anticipation is high in the Gambia as the citizens await the arrival of their new president, Adama Barrow, today, Thursday. Katerina Hoye has more from the Gambian capital, Banjul.
A spokesperson for the president told VOA Adama Barrow will arrive in Banjul on Thursday. Keba Jama is a party secretary for the coalition that supported Barrow in the December election.
The Senegalese government is advising Barrow not to come. It's not safe. It's safe for him to stay in Dakar right now.
West African troops in Banjul, Gambia's capital, have been busy securing the state house and other key areas. Weapon sweeps continued Wednesday. Former President Yahya Jammeh boarded a plane to Guinea Saturday after a tense standoff with regional leaders that saw Senegalese troops deployed to the border, threatening to remove Jammeh by force. Gambia's leader of 22 years was refusing to go, even though he had lost the election. On Tuesday, Gambia's National Assembly voted to lift the state of emergency Jammeh had declared last week in a final attempt to cling to power. Barrow will return home to high expectations. President Barrow says he will set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look into alleged abuses under Jammeh, but he inherits some other hefty challenges. Gambia is one of the world's poorest nations. Thousands of Gambians take the dangerous route across the Sahara Desert and the Mediterranean each year, trying to migrate to Europe. Many here, like Kassi Samura, want Barrow to focus on job creation.
I was a supporter of the former president, but I believe what people decide. That's what we all yearning for. We want progress, peace for our people, development for our people. So we are praying for Barrow, for him to succeed in his tenure office.
A spokesman for Barrow has accused Yahya Jammeh of looting the country's coffers before going into exile. Financial experts are still examining those claims. Katerina Hayet for VOA News, Banjul.
The United Nations has deployed officials to the Gambia to help ensure a smooth transition from former President Yahya Jammeh's government to that of incoming President Adama Barrow. Dr. Mohamed Ibn Chambers, the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa, made this known Wednesday after he briefed the UN Security Council about the current situation in the Gambia. In an interview with VOA's Peter Clarty, Dr. Ibn Chambers said the UN wants to bolster the security of not only President Barrow and his incoming administration, but also Gambian citizens.
It's a very welcome move. A lot of people have been expecting him home. Of course, Gambians and also friends of Gambia. Once he was sworn in, the expectations were that he'll be able to return to the Gambia, particularly after the departure of Yahya Jammeh. Of course, it is understood that he had some legitimate security concerns. Those are being addressed in the short term. Arrangements have been put in place to assure him of his security. But it's a continuing endeavor.
Well, Dr. Chambers, what did you tell members of the Security Council while briefing them about the situation in the Gambia?
What I would like for us to do, and this is what I sought council support for, is to focus on going forward. Immediately, we need to work to assure the security, not only of Mr. Barrow, but of the government that is coming in, and generally of the people in the Gambia. Secondly, we need to support to ensure the continuity of government. It's a new administration coming in. Is taken over from a previous government, what transitional arrangements are in place so that there can be a smooth handover. And the UN has moved very quickly. We have already deployed on the ground an expert on transitions and smooth handover of government. Who will help in that? We also need to, in the short term, look at the economic situation. The international community has to come to the aid of Gambia for a very quick impact support that can be provided to ensure that the finances are there to pay salaries in the short term and for normal economic activities to take off. Going forward, we need to work with Gambians in two important sectors, security sector reform, both military and police, but also other services such as customs, immigration, the justice system, to see how we can strengthen the capacity to deliver justice for the population. And then, of course, the other area will be to work with Gambians generally in the area of reconciliation. Gambians need to come together as one people in this new effort to build and consolidate democracy and develop their country. Within the context of democracy, it means multi-partyism. So, yes, different people would belong to different parties, but they are first and foremost Gambians. And so it is important that the new government creates an environment in which all Gambians, irrespective of their political divide, irrespective of ethnic and religious divide, come together to rebuild their country.
Dr. Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for West Africa. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 26. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the United Nations says it recorded a significant increase in the number of human rights violations committed over the past year and that state security forces were the main perpetrators. William Klaus has the story from Kinshasa.
The UN Joint Human Rights Office has released its report card for the Congo for 2016. The director of the Human Rights Office, José María Arenas, says there was a marked deterioration.
We're particularly worried about a dramatic increase in human rights violations documented in the territory of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Our office has documented 5,190 human rights violations, which represent a 30% increase compared to 2015, which was already a year of increase compared to 2014.
DRC government spokesman Lambert Mende told VOA that the figures sound exaggerated, but declined further comment as he says he has not yet seen the report. The UN says Congolese security forces committed most of the documented violations, while the rest were attributed to armed groups active in the east of the country.
It's a matter of particular concern, the fact that state agents are responsible for the majority of these abuses. They committed 64% of the violations and left behind 480 victims of extrajudicial killings and summary executions. The main perpetrator of human rights abuses in the country is the national police, followed by the army and the national intelligence services.
The report draws special attention to the restriction of political rights, which Arenas said quadrupled in the past year amid opposition to delayed elections. On New Year's Eve, President Joseph Kabila's ruling alliance and most of the opposition signed an agreement. If it is implemented, this deal paves the way both for the delayed elections to take place in late 2017 and the departure of the president, whose second and final term expired last month. Arenas says it is crucial to ensure political freedoms during this precarious transition.
There is also a specific part in the political agreement signed on the 31st of December that refers to confidence-building measures, which refers basically to opening of the democratic space, release of political prisoners or prisoners of opinion. We've been advocating that these confidence-building measures go beyond the political prisoners element and include lifting the banning on demonstrations for the opposition, stop instrumentalization of the judiciary, bring the perpetrators of human rights abuses to justice, allow for media professionals to conduct their activities in a healthy environment and without threats, and for the police to refrain from using lethal weapons in crowd control.
Earlier this week, Congolese authorities ejected a Human Rights Watch researcher from the country for the second time. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
A gang rape video recorder in central Somalia could serve as a powerful test case for Puntland State's new sexual violence regulation and potentially for the rule of law in general in Somalia. Jason Patinki has the story from Nairobi, Kenya.
A group of men arrested and accused of gang raping and stabbing a pair of young girls in Somalia's Puntland state in December could face the death penalty or life imprisonment if they are found guilty, that is, if the state takes the case.
This case is the first case that recalls for enforcement of the Sexual Offense Act. This is a test for Puntland government's accountability in front of the international law, in front of the national laws, and also in front of their people.
Lawyer Salim Saeed drafted the new law, which Puntland enacted in December. It is the first law in all of Somalia to criminalize sexual assault. The new act draws on modern Western jurisprudence and is compliant with Islamic Sharia law. In Puntland, the alleged perpetrators recorded the assault of one of the girls and posted it online, sparking national and international outrage. Somalia's Minister of Gender, Sara Samantar.
Impunity is one of our biggest issues in Somalia. A lot of similar rape happens in Somalia, but it's not publicly spoken. But the fact that now they posted on the social media, that gives at least the whole world to see indeed what happens in Somalia.
Most rapes go unreported and unpunished in Somalia, but there is hope this case will usher in change. But there is no guarantee the law will prevail because Somalia's government, even at the state level, has little real control after decades of war. Saeed says in most parts of Somalia, local clan elders dispense informal justice through what is known as customary law. In customary law, rapists often only pay a fine as punishment, or the victims are forced to marry their attackers.
Since the collapse of the former central government in 1991, customary law is one which prevails. The power is in the hands of the elders. They are taking advantage of the weakness of the rule of law and also the weakness of the government. If the Puntland government want to show they are accountable, I think they will not hesitate to take action and to take over this case.
A bill similar to the Puntland Sexual Offenses Act has been in the federal parliament for over a year, according to Antonia Mulvey, CEO of Legal Action Worldwide, which works with Somalia's legal system on sexual assault.
We want to now use this as an opportunity to present the sexual offenses bill and have the public pressure upon them to pass it in its current form. And so I hope this will galvanize religious leaders and the parliament to move it forward.
With so much on the line, rights advocates will be closely watching to see if the accused in this case in Puntland wind up in a state courtroom. Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Nairobi.
The head of Human Rights Watch, the New York-based rights group, is warning that the global rise of populism will likely erode human rights and democratic values globally. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says he believes populist leaders who claim to speak for the people use this supposed status to trample on the rights of vulnerable minorities. When politicians begin to chip away at the rights of the few, he warns that ends up destabilizing the rights of the many. He says he fears the global rise of populism will weaken the global commitment to human rights values. He says it will whittle away many of the pillars on which the United Nations and the human rights instruments on which it was founded were built.
I'm very concerned that we will lose the U.S. voice as a defender of human rights around the world. We don't know that yet. You know, it's still too early to say. But it's a big worry. You know, given Trump's expressed admiration for strongmen and his appointment of a man as Secretary of State, or his nomination of a man who has yet to show any interest in human rights.
Roth says the United States has been an important voice and model for civil society in many countries, but he fears many governments will use the opportunity of Trump's arrival to crack down on dissent. He says the United States can no longer be counted on to take a leadership role in upholding human rights values, so other nations must jump in and take over. Roth cautions Trump against partnering with Russian President Vladimir Putin in an effort to eradicate the Islamic State group, or ISIS. He tells VOA, Putin's counterterrorism strategy is to obliterate cities seen as sympathetic to terrorists.
That is a pretty stupid way to fight terrorism. Because, you know, in the Syrian context, where you bring up ISIS, that is seen as an anti-Sunni policy. It is seen as, you know, utter disregard for Sunni life. And in an atmosphere of that sort, ISIS thrives.
Roth says the key to fighting radical Islam is to build inclusive societies so people, regardless of their sect, have a place. He says following the Putin approach of indiscriminate warfare is not a smart way to fight Islamic State. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump signed orders on Wednesday for the construction of a wall along the country's southern border with Mexico as part of his plans to thwart illegal migration, limit the admission of refugees into the U.S., and confront so-called sanctuary citizens that are protecting undocumented migrants. Elizabeth Cherniff has more.
President Trump spoke to ABC News about his promise to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
You have to understand what I'm doing is good for the United States. It's also going to be good for Mexico. We want to have a very stable, very solid Mexico.
For ranchers along the border, the move may be good news. They complain that illegal migrants break fences and start fires. Jim Chilton also says a wall would stop migrants from putting their lives at risk in the hot desert.
If they secured the border, people wouldn't be dying on our ranch.
But immigrant rights advocates like Reverend Randy Meyer oppose the wall.
This wall signifies a lack of respect for our neighbors and people that we should be embracing and building bridges towards.
In Hyattsville, Maryland, undocumented immigrants have been meeting with volunteers, learning what to do when approached by law enforcement. Trump has said he plans to beef up immigration enforcement.
Trump has a lot of power, and I think that scares a lot of us.
But Dan Stein, president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, says that these practices make it difficult for authorities to enforce the law.
What really these organizations are doing are trying to make it difficult for law enforcement to actually determine who has a right to be here and who doesn't, for the purposes of obstructing immigration law enforcement.
Rutland, Vermont Mayor Christopher Loris hoped to bring 100 Syrian refugees to the city this year.
We saw refugee resettlement as an opportunity not only to do the right thing, the compassionate and humanitarian thing, but also from a very self-serving perspective as a community, provide population growth to fill our jobs.
But reports are that President Trump may cut off refugees from Syria and other countries the administration says are terrorist-prone. Meanwhile, U.S. sanctuary cities like New York are awaiting word that President Trump may cut their federal funding unless they renounce their sanctuary status. Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Somalia officials say dozens of people were killed or wounded when Al-Shabaab militants attacked a Mogadishu hotel with two vehicle bombs and a gun assault on Wednesday. And that's it for this Thursday, January 26 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Barty here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting Wednesday, February 1st, and continuing throughout the month, we will begin our Black History Month and daily quiz series on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African Americans and African individuals and events. Send us your country's historical moment in February. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
Get up, stand up, stand up.